Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio. This is your host, Kevin Barrett, doing this every Tuesday night right here on We the People Radio Network. And tonight I'm going to be delving into a very pernicious and disreputable topic among certain sensitive people in the 9/11 truth movement, but one that I really kind of enjoy myself. I'm going to be talking with a couple of pernicious and disreputable people who I also kind of enjoy. My guests tonight are going to be at the upcoming Science of 9/11 conference in Madison, Wisconsin.
I'm sick and tired of human things from uptight, short-sighted, not on my hypocrite.
Of these crazy egocentric NSA people who are screwing around with our telephone connections on this radio show. What happened here? Apparently all phone lines just went down. Oh boy. Well, we've come back up. So let me pick up where I left off. I was just about to say that we have a couple of very fascinating guests on tonight. Folks, these guys are a little bit disreputable in certain quarters of the 9/11 truth movement. Why? Because they're out front with some cutting edge research that is controversial, and that's why they're going to be at the upcoming Madison Scholars for 9/11 Truth Conference, which is entitled Science of 9/11: What's Controversial and What's Not. We're going to try to figure out exactly what we can all agree on, like Building 7 was a controlled demolition, and what we can't. What's with the planes on 9/11? And you know, this is a perfectly reasonable thing to do, I think. I think we need to get together and all, do kind of a big high five on Building 7 and then hear each other out on these other research matters. It's really not a big deal, and I think that 9/11 truth activists really need to lighten up and let the researchers do their research and critique that we need to critique the research in a friendly and also rigorous way. And so that's why I'm having a couple of the most out there, cutting edge researchers who have some of the best scientific credentials. Well, one of them does. The other has good economics credentials. And I'll start out with the first guest. He's a former Bush administration chief economist at the U.S. Department of Labor from 2001-2002. And after he quit, he rocked the world with some statements about the controlled demolition of the World Trade Center. And since then, he's been a big name in the 9/11 truth movement. That's, of course, Dr. Morgan Reynolds. Are you there, Morgan? Hello, Morgan. Well, maybe Morgan's not back up here yet. We're going to try to get him back up. Apparently, we had everybody on the phone lines, and then something happened. I hope I'm still on the air right now. I'd feel pretty silly if I were sitting here doing this and wasn't getting through the telephone line. Anyway, we are going to have Morgan Reynolds on. Morgan Reynolds is a professor emeritus of economics at Texas A&M University. He's a former chief economist at the U.S. Department of Labor, and he was the director of the Criminal Justice Center, as well as a senior fellow at the National Center for Policy Analysis. in Dallas, Texas. Morgan has some pretty serious credentials, and so when he started talking about the demolition of the Trade Center, some folks probably didn't like that too much. but those of us who were already on it were overjoyed, and I've gotten to know Morgan a little bit, and I have to say I like you, Morgan. I don't care what you have to say about those planes hitting or not hitting the towers. I think you've done some good work, and I'm going to really be happy to see you when you come up to the Science of 9/11 conference in August. So, hey, welcome, Morgan.
Hey, good evening, Kevin. Hey, I like you, too, and the fact that you're in error on a few points is just between friends.
Yeah, well, that's the way it's got to be because, you know, this 9/11 thing is so outrageously complex. It's so multifaceted. There are so many different areas to look at that, you know, nobody really has time to at least to do activism and also to be up on every last aspect of this thing. So, you know, I'm willing to allow people to look into particular facets of 9/11 more closely than I have. And to speak their minds about what they're looking at. And I think that's the least we can do. And then, you know, have a dialogue aimed at, you know, critiquing people's research. And
well, yeah, let's look at the facts as best we can ascertain them.
And you certainly wrote a very good piece on the demolitions. That's one that has certainly withstood the test of time for just about everybody in the 9/11 truth movement. There are very few rejecting controlled demolition these days. And so when they go back and read your articles on that from a few years ago, they look pretty good. Even your bête noir, Jim Hoffman, admitted that most of what you had to say about controlled demolition was right on.
Yeah, and it didn't pretend to be original research so much as putting it together in plain language. And I think I'm a pretty good teacher as well as researcher, so... He was mostly bent out of shape with my suspicions about the plane stories, which I hadn't sorted out nearly as well as I have since. And, Kevin, just to reinforce your point about let's be we can disagree, but we don't have to be disagreeable about it. We've got to make, as in physical science, you've got to make the world safe for error. Actually, some errors turn out to be very provocative and promote knowledge, the development of new knowledge. So our first resort, I would claim, should not be, oh, that guy's an op or so-and-so's a troll, until you accumulate enough circumstantial evidence to prove it up.
Absolutely. You know, actually, the idea of productive error is something that was popular in postmodern literary theory when I was studying literature. And I think it's true. People need to be free to make mistakes and not, you know, not be, you know, raked over the coals. Especially, you know, with 9/11, we're faced with such a tangle of information that it's pretty hard to sort it all out. And, you know, I've read a fair bit of your stuff, including your essay in the new book, The 9/11 Conspiracy, The Scamming of America, which is edited by Jim Fetzer, and I think it passes the test as basically, you know, lucid analysis and writing. So I really wonder about these folks who don't want to even come to a conference because somebody's coming there who has a controversial theory.
Maybe.
Dave von Kleist was supposed to come up to Vancouver, and then somebody there said, "Oh, we don't like this pods on the plane hitting the towers thing." So because of one person didn't like him, they didn't invite him.
Well,
and now
yeah.
Apparently Dave is kind of scratching his head about coming to be on the program with you, Morgan, because he thinks that his tweaking of the standard plane story is going to be, you know, is going to look crazy if it gets lumped together with your version of what may have happened with the plane. So why can't we all just get together and hash these things out,
right,
and agree to disagree?
I mean, hey, I'm as you have. We're willing to go into the lion's den. There's if you're secure in your approach, why not? And you know, hey, look at Hannity and Combs and O'Reilly. There, you're not going to get a hearing, a word in edgewise. So you just got to go in and pound it, and stay on message, right? And not let them trample you.
You know, David Gray Griffin, as a theologian, I think had some good insights on the sociology kind of the 9/11 truth movement. And he pointed out that in religious movements, people with different ideas sometimes get accused of heresy, and that these movements split apart into competing factions that get very angry at each other. And you know, we shouldn't be like a faith-based movement. With the 9/11 truth movement, we should be a little bit more, you know, rigorously analytical and yet convivial and collegial, don't you think?
Well, yeah, and secular disputes, be they scientific or political, at least in principle, are resolvable. And the truth will out long run. Most of us are very confident of that. Error often wins round one. It doesn't worry me. The truth has legs. If I'm peddling BS, it won't stand the test of time. Now, I claim on this planes, no planes issue, there were no planes in all four events that crashed, and I can prove it up. And it's funny that, you know, the burden is really not on me so much as the advocates. And if I can refute them with one fact, one fact that falsifies the theory is enough that you have to go back to, into the workshop and reformulate it. And the number one fact, and there are, I got dozens of them, is the paucity of debris at all four alleged crash sites.
You know, that's a good point.
These Boeings are have about 3 million parts. And then there are body parts, mail, lipstick, on and on and on. Where is this stuff? We're very familiar with airliner crashes, what it looks like. And
right.
none of the four look like that at all.
Well, you know, David Griffin, again, made that point talking about the controversy about the Pentagon. You know, he pointed out that when a tin can hits the wall and it squashes, the mass of the tin can is still there. So where is the evidence that 100 tons of aluminum and steel ever was taken out of the Pentagon?
Yeah, the Pentagon is the clearest case that is close to a consensus, and the facts are so compelling that there was no Flight 77, and I would go further. There wasn't any Sky Warrior A4 either, because the same facts refute that. And, you know, probably the two most important things that you could cite, top of the fact list, refuting the official account, would be, number one, the gash is on the neighborhood of 16-foot diameter. How can that swallow a 125-foot width 757, and it's about 40 feet high?
Right.
So the gash is a problem. And then, to me, the next most important fact is, if you're going to contend that this plane, as officially, came in at over 500 miles an hour, you cannot land this type of aircraft. And that's what they're telling us. It landed at the first and second story, okay?
Right.
That's
they
equivalent to
and there's
not a mark on
the
lawn, you know, on and on.
Have you looked at the Pilots for 9/11 Truth work about the black box data?
Yeah, I guess that's helpful, but it's hard for an outsider to evaluate their work, right? You can't check on it. But what they are saying is that given this official flight path, it couldn't have knocked down the lamppost and it couldn't have hit the building. Is that your impression also?
That's exactly what they're saying, and that would suggest that there may have been some kind of overflight if this is indeed a real black box.
Yeah, one of the, you know, speaking of an overflight, one of the things that makes me maddest about that event is that it's acknowledged that this C-130 with Colonel Steve O'Brien in command overflew the Pentagon event, and then he's the same guy who was near Shanksville. And these, some 19 or so of these C-130s are fixed all up with this, these black box jamming and so on. And that guy, I was there in Washington, D.C., of course, on 9/11. And that guy, that lying guy, this really makes me mad for a military officer, said, "Oh, yeah, I couldn't, you really couldn't see because the East Coast haze was obstructing my view." Well, that's just an outrageous lie. That was the clearest day on the East Coast in the history of man, and everybody knows it.
So wait a second. Now, Steve O'Brien, you're saying he was piloting one of those C-130 airborne command
right.
and control planes. And what's the evidence that he was doing that in over
D.C.? Well, the military, it was widely reported, but they acknowledge it, that he was over, that he was diverted. And so they fess up that he was there. And he said, I just couldn't see the hit at the Pentagon, was his claim, because of this haze. There was no haze.
Interesting, because, you know, that C-130, some people think that the official story conflates that C-130 is flying over D.C. with the flight path of the alleged 757. Okay, well, we're going to have to take a break here, but we'll be back with Morgan Reynolds and hopefully his co-author, Rick Ratcher, in a few moments. Stay tuned. Okay, let's not tolerate any outrageous conspiracy theories like that 19 hijackers and led by a guy on dialysis in a cave in Afghanistan legend that they tried to sell us. Let's talk about the more commonsensical ones like TV fakery and no planes flying into the World Trade Center. Whoa, let's not go there. Well, actually, maybe we are going to go there tonight because my guests tonight right here on 9/11 Empire Radio are Morgan Reynolds and Rick Ratcher, and they've raised a little bit of controversy around those issues, and I see no harm in talking about them. Hey, I hear Rick is on the line. Rick
should be. Do you hear me?
Yeah, how are you doing?
Oh, sweet. I was beginning to think I was in a protective box over here.
Sorry about that. We had a little technical difficulties there at the beginning of the show where the phone lines all apparently disappeared at one point, but they're back.
No worries. I'm here now.
All right. So, enjoyed your piece. You guys are the joint authors of an article called Some Holes in the Plane Stories, which is in the book The 9/11 Conspiracy, The Scamming of America, and it's by Jim Fetzer. And I think that's an interesting line of argument to argue that essentially all four alleged plane crashes have little or no evidence to support them and apparently a fair bit of evidence that they didn't happen the way we're told they did. In a way, it kind of simplifies things to see them all in that same light, whereas a lot of people in the 9/11 truth movement seem to admit the doubts about the plane crashes in Washington and Shanksville, but they don't have so many doubts about the crashes in the World Trade Center. So maybe we just start off here. I guess I could just ask you, Morgan, how did you first get off on this tangent of the questions about the alleged plane crashes into the World Trade Center?
When I did this article that caught some attention June 9th, it appeared on Lou Rockwell, a libertarian website back in June of 2005, I explained that let's put everything aside that we supposedly know and look at the evidence from scratch. And I hadn't figured out the planes, but a number of things looked suspicious. I didn't trust the plane stories, especially at the World Trade Center. And I didn't know that much. I actually reviewed that recently, and I had a link to the Web Ferry. But I didn't know about Gerard Holmgren, et cetera. So I just, and Jim Hoffman jumped on me and about the first third of the article, because that was the chronology. You know, first of all, we see these gashes and explosions in the towers. Well, what caused them? I wasn't going to accept anything without a strong evidential basis. So I raised these questions. I didn't say there were no planes because I hadn't reached that conclusion. And then I went on to, if you will, prove or reprove, reword the demolitions, the inside job nature that was irrefutable. And about that time, that summer, it used to be verboten to talk about this. For example, Mike Rupert was one of those who said, you know, you don't ever talk about physical evidence because it's just disputed. It's one expert versus the other. And about this time, a few months later, I'm not taking credit. Some people say I'm an op because, at any rate, a consensus kind of congealed. You know, you can't figure out how these things are, but enough years had gone into this and enough evidence that it just became, oh, yeah, everybody takes it for granted, right?
Yeah, you know, that's really interesting because, you know, when Rupert said that, he had a lot of influence at that point. And I think it really slowed things down, because the demolitions are really pretty darn obvious, especially Building 7. It's one of those things you can see with your own eyes, and, you know, when people see Building 7 coming down, they often rethink their whole approach to 9/11. So I think Rupert was very counterproductive in urging people not to look at that.
Your intro had Ace Baker as my favorite 9/11 song, Blown to Kingdom Come. You know, if only because I'm known for the praise applied to this case, but it is based on a Daryl Worley country song.
Yeah, you know, I tried to popularize that phrase. I thought it was it had legs, and so anyway,
well,
you were
come out. Hey, you were the one who coined the "Come on out from the White House with your hands up."
Yeah, I thought that was a good summary of your talk in Madison, which was basically sort of a prosecutorial brief against the administration that you used to work for.
Right.
But Kevin, that was an important point that you brought up earlier, though, about the consensus of the trade centers becoming more popular around 2005, because for the first 4 years, you weren't really allowed to at these conferences to talk about even the controversial controlled demolition. But now, you know, if you're not talking, you know, controlled demolition, you're off. So it's like truth by democracy within a movement we got going on right now.
Yeah, and I think we do need to ease up on that. And it's, I think part of the problem is that the kind of the sociology of this has become sort of like a religious movement. You know, when people
right.
see the world in a totally different way from the other people around them, which happens when, you know, when people like, you know, suddenly get turned on to cosmic truth by some, you know, a guru or prophet or something, you know, then they wander around following that person, and they, there's a whole sociology that happens where you have to be absolutely right about everything. It's kind of a, you know, if you're wrong about your this, you're a heretic. And that kind of mentality seems to me to really, you know, be kind of infesting the 9/11 truth movement. And we need to kind of relax and not be quite so dogmatic about
something. Hey, Kevin, let me take the other side of that, though, because this is not for sure entirely unfounded, and that is the perpetrators had years to plan this, and they would plan for the post 9/11. And you would certainly, although they've got control of the influential media, the corporate media, that's not enough in the internet age, and or alternative radio. So they would put people in place to lead the new 9/11 truth movement. It's only logical. I'm not saying I can go to court with this, but. We've got to realize that some people actually are operatives. It's not just the kind of the NSA key pounders on forums who are like they never read a Reynolds article or a Judy Wood article or Rick Ryder, but you know, they're tarring and feathering these people. So hey, there are ops out there.
Well, it may very well be the case, but I think we really don't need to waste our time worrying about them because I think there's a limited amount of damage that can be done by people like that. And, you know, number one, how competent a person can they get to play that role? That is, you know,
it depends on the pay.
Right, right. Okay, so we should probably be checking people coming to 9/11 truth conferences, you know, dressed in, you know, alligator shoes and, you know, wearing, you know, diamond jewelry.
Wearing a fedora.
Yeah. Oh,
well, I mean, to go back to that, though, I mean, at least for the first few years at these conferences, they would not let certain people talk about controlled demolition at these conferences. Nico Hopp was a big one. Where they actually threw him out of his own conference. So it doesn't take much, because all you got to do is have pressure from the people running the conference to not let that type of information in, and yeah, it's a way you control the information. So, you know, the people at the cutting edge who were talking about controlled demolition in 2002 to 2004 were stifled by these people in the movement. And so we're kind of facing a similar type of
history. Rick repeats itself on the no planes front, because Judy and I think under not entirely open, fair circumstances, got invited up to Seattle in October. And supposedly the 9/11 movement up there is in disarray or fractured since our talk. But Judy and I have not been invited anywhere. So, for example, hey, our names come up, or our quote, you know, space beam theories, or rabid no planners come up at Vancouver or out in Chandler, Arizona, but we're not there.
Well, you're the bad boys and girls of the movement, boys. I guess. Anyway, we'll be back doing some more talk with the bad boys in just a few moments. This is Kevin Nerd right here on 9/11 and Empire Radio. Stay tuned. That's right, we're back with the bad boys. Morgan Reynolds and Rick Ryder at 9/11 and Empire Radio. This is your host, Kevin Durrett, doing this every Tuesday night. And I'm still a free speech guy, so I'm not interested in trying to ignore interesting, provocative, and controversial ideas about September 11th. My own are considered that in some quarters. So we're talking about the evidence that the plane crashes that supposedly happened on September 11th don't seem to have a whole lot of evidence for them, and there seems to be a fair bit of evidence against them. Well, you know, one thing that comes up when people consider this idea, Morgan and Rick, is that they would say that, you know, the perps in this instance would probably want to, you know, KISS, keep it simple, stupid. That is, they wouldn't want to be using a lot of unproven, relatively untested, you know, high-technology stuff. I mean, you'd think that they would want to go with what was tried and true, because it's already going to be complicated enough. And according to this one line of argument, the simplest thing to do would be simply fly these planes into their targets by remote control rather than engaging in fancy plane substitutions or God knows what other kind of, you know, crazy hijinks to create the illusions of plane crashes when there were none. So why, you know, why do you think that, since you seem to believe the perps did not use big Boeings, why not? Wouldn't it have been a lot easier to do that?
Well, let me respond first, and then Rick, you chime in.
Sure.
They actually did follow KISS with this. There's way too many problems using real airliners. Too many things can go wrong. For example, suppose you missed the building. John Lear was on the pilots for 9/11 Truth, and the host chimed in with there were a couple of experienced airliner pilots on simulators that morning of 9/11, and they both tried to hit a tower at 500 miles an hour, and they couldn't do it. Much less these inexperienced alleged Arab hijackers. But the perps knew what the physics of this were, where you have an aluminum tin can basically with a couple of motors. What the building, a heavy steel building, is going to do to this? It's going to chew the butt. It's going to crush, crumple, torque that plane to nowhere. Yeah, I've looked at a lot of these crash. There aren't that many, actually, a couple dozen maybe, crash videos for aircraft. And you go in, you know, the way I like to put it is I've got a sledgehammer in the basement here, 9.5 pounds. You put me up on a Boeing 767 or 757 for 15 minutes, it will be unflyable. 9.5 pounds of steel. You know how many, when I flew up to Seattle, I was on a 767, and I was over the wing. I was watching it as we approached the airport. It, quite a ballet of actuators, you know, moving flaps and panels. And all over the wing are markings, no step, no step. In other words, a 200-pound man can go up there and create some damage walking on that wing, okay? So these planes, you know, they don't have any crash ratings, do they, Kevin? So they, and, you know, the ace in the hole for doing this way, it this way, is they have control of the media. They can psyop you to death by claiming this is real and do a video fakery, do an insert. Rick?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with the keeping it simple. It's much easier to, you know, if you had to put some maybe shake charges into the wall, or, you know, if you believe the thermite hypothesis or any bombs in the building or whatever, they could already have that in place to make any cutouts they need. And FEMA was there the day before to do simulations of things running into the tower, so they could put fake blips on all the monitors, and they could already have the video edited out. And again, yeah, to get a real plane and have that much accuracy, again, if the plane nose, like, missed the corner, right, and only a wing hit the building, you know, and if the building fell after that, first of all, you have two problems. You'd have to explain how just a wing hit in the building could cause it to collapse. That would be, you know, absurd.
Right.
And then you'd have the plane land in some other place in Manhattan and, you know, doing all sorts of other damage. And so they didn't want that at all. So it's much, much easier to just do, you know, it sounds crazy at first sight. But when you really think of how simple it would be to, you know, fake it, it's actually so much easier. You don't have to deal with insurance. You don't have to deal with stealing a plane from American Airlines and having to, like, deal with them and all this stuff.
Right.
So
yeah.
there's a lot of pluses and simplifications that go about with no plane.
Yeah.
Well, yes and no. I mean, you know, there's
problems
too.
They have to tie the airline penetration, quote unquote, and the subsequent destruction of both towers, which are awesomely strong. And it wouldn't do much good to run a Boeing in and watch it crumple and fall to the ground below, most of it. Now, an engine, it's true. If it didn't hit a floor, you know, if it were just right, could conceivably go right through a tower. But that's very improbable. It happened in 1945 with that B-24. But you got to hit it just right. Otherwise, the floor, much less the core, is going to stop all that stuff. So it would look pathetic to run what a plane would really do running in there. And you wouldn't have it all set up for the subsequent destruction, which supposedly was due to fires and weakening of the structure.
And Kevin, remember that even if it was remote controlled, if there was a real plane and if there was people on board, you know, if the plane was overtaken and, you know, the people on board knew it was flying towards a tower or whatever, who's to say they couldn't just destroy it en route or whatever and have it, you know, crash the plane like, you know, allegedly that was what happened in Shanksville with the Let's Roll crap. So, again, you know, you add so many variables at what could cause this to fail along the way.
Well, here's
having real planes.
Here's another problem you're moving toward, Rick, and that is there is no stand-down order. Nobody will ever find a valid stand-down order. There are too many patriots in the military. There's too much a defense that is decentralized. It's not true that Rumsfeld would have to sign off on an airliner intercept, et cetera. So there's way too many complications just in terms of an air defense.
Well, it does seem as though there was a kind of a procedure that led to in effect, a stand-down order.
Plane simplifies all that. there's nothing to intercept.
Wait a minute, Morgan. If there are, air fighters flying around trying to intercept what they think is a hijacking, you know, because we did apparently, the FAA people talk about, the various notifications.
They never intercepted anything. And, of course,
But if they were flying around looking for something and there was nothing there, if they're patriots, like you say, wouldn't they tell us that?
Well, there's a good question. Would they tell us that? Why don't we have an insider come forward with the truth? Yeah, here's my answer. You know, we were also happy, for example, when Stephen Jones first stepped forward. He was the only tenured university physicist that was going to question the official story. Well, look at what we've got here in terms of the science and engineering community. It's an absolute, we might as well have the Soviet Union in terms of the government having them all in its hip pocket for various reasons that amount to its career suicide to challenge the government on something this crucial.
And yet there are more and more scientists who are doing that, as well as architects and engineers. There's that new group, Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. And, of course, people in other nations have perhaps less to fear from the U.S. government. So there's really, there's no reason why this blackout in the scientific community should hold forever.
But it's been a bad performance so far. Go ahead, Rick.
Kevin, there really is, though, because are you going to get NSF grants and DOD grants if you're a 9/11 truth person? No. So you know, it's career suicide. You basically might as well throw your funding out the door, you know, tell your grad students you can't pay for them anymore and forget being invited to talks or getting papers published. So, yeah, there may not be an official you're kicked out the door and fired, but you're really going to severely hamper a career. And all these professors, remember, they had to get PhDs, they had to put a lot of money on the line, they put years of work on this to build what they are, and, you know, they have a comfortable life. They're not going to...
Well, I know that from hard personal experience, because the engineering school at the University of Wisconsin lost at least $500,000 because I was not fired there last year. So anyway, we'll come back and pick this up where we left off. This is Kevin Barrett talking with Rick Ryder and Morgan Reynolds right here on We the People Radio Network. Stay with us. And World Trade Center worker William Rodriguez is now touring the UK, I believe. He's running around Europe talking to good-sized crowds. I believe he filled up the largest mosque in the UK not too long ago. So, hey, keep at it, Willie. And all right, well, you know, William Rodriguez, of course, did witness explosions in the North Tower immediately before the alleged airplane impact, as well as afterwards. And we do have all sorts of eyewitness, ear witness testimony for these explosions in the Twin Towers and also Building 7. And we now have new testimony from a witness who tells us that a massive explosion killed many people. And it was apparently pre-demolition work went off while the towers were still standing somewhere after 9 in the morning. So, guys, let's face it, there were some explosions, right?
No, yeah, that's not, if you look at Rick Siegel's 9/11 eyewitness, sure, there's overwhelming evidence that I don't think is questioned by anyone that there are these explosions going on.
But I guess, you know, Morgan, you've been identified with this argument that some kind of high-energy weapon may have contributed to the destruction of the towers. And this is where it seems to me that there's kind of a, you know, it's not an either-or, but it's a both-and. And it seems to me that Stephen Jones' arguments are actually stronger than you give him credit for, in that the evidence for these conventional explosives and for thermite seems to be quite strong, and of course that doesn't rule out the possibility that something else might have been used as well. So what's the fight about there? Is this all making a mountain out of a molehill?
Oh no, I've helped Dr. Judy Wood, who's a PhD in engineering, in what I call the dissertation project, which is still not finalized, but there is evidence that is overwhelming that something unconventional, call it outrageous, Kevin. You know, when George W. Bush addressed the United Nations in October of 2001 and says, let us not entertain outrageous conspiracy theories, what he's telling us is we did it an outrageous way. Now, what kind of evidence? Well, I knew about these, basically these 24-foot diameter holes drilled in the outbuildings of WTC, buildings 4, 5, and 6 in particular. But nobody had an explanation for it. And, of course, I think it was done by a directed energy weapon. That's what you're left with, ultimately. Then we have, of course, these some 1,400 toasted cars, some of them toasted in very odd ways. And, of course, there's evidence that we've used these directed energy weapons in Iraq. So, in fact, somebody claimed, now I know who it is, that we might have even, this is giving us too much influence, perhaps, but that they could take out certain facilities in Iran if they wanted to with directed energy weapons. They've been working on these things, of course, for decades. We all know about microwaves and laser beams, right? Well, is that where it ends? You know, they had the laser in the mid-1950s. So, and then there's this whole problem. If you go to our long paper, I don't see how any fair-minded person can look at all the evidence that Judy and with my help has assembled and not entertain this idea and find it compelling, in fact. You know about the bathtub, for example. You cannot have a half a million tons of debris falling on this bathtub and hope to keep the Hudson River at bay. They took all this into account. So that what they basically did was, in effect, disappear the upper 80% plus of each tower. You know where all that dust came from, Kevin? All those nanoparticles, 1 inch and more thick throughout the south of the island of Manhattan? What is that? That's a tower.
Well, that's right. There's the argument that if you packed enough firepower with conventional explosives, you could get a similar result. At least that's the argument I've heard.
Well, right. It just takes you a lot more, and you have to basically have it placed throughout the entire building where, you know, whether you look at the directed energy approach, as some people advocate, and there's other people that advocate mini nukes or whatever particular exotic weapon you look at, you need less of it, which is a plus, and it's easier to get in, which is a plus. So,
right. The question would be also, has this been tested as a way to demolish large steel buildings in the past? Because you would, as I said, you know, with KISS, you would expect that the perps would do stuff that's reasonably tried and true, that they know is going to work. Because if it really goes wrong, they're kind of stuck holding
the
bag.
Well, you know, they did learn on the job. That's why they did the South Tower first. We explained that. You know, the top 300 feet plus, they actually had it tilt against the opening, which is contrary to what you'd otherwise expect, right? You know, they should have.
That's pretty odd, isn't it?
yeah. But if you look at the layout, Judy explains this because they're going to do building four anyway. So you tilt it there, and of course, then they pulverized it. Even Jones, Professor Jones, remarks that, well, gee whiz, I don't know, it never did come down that way. fall on building four.
He admits that's a mystery.
It's not a mystery if you were to use some external directed energy weapon. Now, we actually get criticized for not having the serial numbers from the parts of this weapon. Well, we're not privy to the technology they have, but we have, like, I don't know, 8-9 pages of proof that they've got directed energy weapons. So
well, the question
what they learned in 30 minutes about doing the South Tower, which was in a sense a little sloppier, they had to do this safe way. The North Tower was a bit neater, although they had, of course, some of the core was very stubborn, the so-called spire, which then dissociates it. It's steel turning to dust. People deny this, even though the video and photographic evidence is overwhelming, that they turn. There's not enough debris at the bottom, Kevin. You didn't walk up 10 stories on a debris pile, you know.
Right. It's clearly not a conventional controlled demolition that uses gravity to bring down the building. It's obviously being blown to kingdom come,
they
as you said in the moral words.
Nanoparticles. They dissociated the stuff. It wasn't just the concrete. You know, in a conventional demolition, of course, you'd have all the material broken up at the bottom. And you didn't have any of this reinforced steel down there.
Right. And that means that there were, there's a lot more explosive, destructive energy being unleashed than you would have in a normal demolition.
Mm-hmm.
And that does raise the question of the source of the energy.
Material that shouldn't unravel in an ordinary explosive.
Right. Well, the question is, you know, to what, you know, what do you really gain by pushing this? You know, there are some people, like I know Professor A.K. Dudney, man for whom I have a fair bit of respect. You know, he did state this in a perhaps unfortunate terms by saying that, well, even if I did have proof that there were, you know, no planes hit the towers, I wouldn't be talking about it in public. Well, that's obviously going a little too far, but there is also, you know,
too far for me.
Well, me too. But also there's some merit to the Steve Jones position, which is, look, if I can prove, that conventional explosives or thermite were used, if I can prove that up, I've got, you know, chemical tests here proving that they were used. I've got proof of arson. We take that into court and we go out, you know.
Here's your problem. Double jeopardy. You only get one bite of the apple when you're prosecuting people. And Stephen Jones admits Thermite is not an insider type product, or even super duper thermite thermate. You can get it on eBay.
To set up the demolition with it, of course, you have to be an insider to set up the demolition.
No, thermite has never been used in a building demolition. It's a steel cutter, you know.
Right, but he's just saying it's part of the story, though. He's not saying it's the whole story.
Well, it's a limited hangout. That's the bottom line.
I don't agree. I think if he can prove up the thermite, then you can, you know, get a prosecutor and bring him in there and grill him
the real kicker here is there's two reasons why, if we're right, which of course I am, directed energy weapons are important. Number one, it's the truth. That's important on its own. I got my PhD based on that kind of noble idea, and I still hold it.
Truth will set you free, says the University of Wisconsin.
Yeah, hey, sifting and winnowing.
That's right.
Number two, only the United States military could have done it this way. In other words, there's no wiffle waffling about who did it. Who did it.
Right, but I'd say we're already long past the point of whiffling and waffling about that. We know that this was an inside job by people who had access to the special forces type units of the military and so on and so forth.
Kevin, I cannot be that cavalier because I want a prosecution, as you well know. And you don't go to court with the weak stuff. You got to go with the strong stuff.
Well, I agree with that. And that's why we need a free and fair debate to find out what exactly is the strong stuff. And that's what we'll be doing at our upcoming conference in Madison, Wisconsin, August 3rd to 5th. Stay with us. We'll be back for more in just a few minutes. Okay, we're back right here on 9/11 and Empire Radio. This is your host, Kevin Barrett. And we are looking for the truth, no matter where it may lead, even into outrageous conspiracy theories. Well, what happened on 9/11, you can't really talk about it unless you entertain outrageous conspiracy theories. And tonight we're entertaining some of the more outrageous ones. Theories so outrageous that even the most conspiracy theorists blanch in horror and sometimes even faint. But I think it's worth talking about this because, well, number one, I've looked into it enough to think that there may very well be something to it. And secondly, I think it's silly to be ostracizing anybody who's presenting a well-researched, thought-out, and coherent argument, at least, you know, on the surface. And, you know, we're going to have a conference in Madison to try and hash this stuff out. It's called The Science of 9/11. What's controversial and what's not? It's happening on the 3rd to 5th of August. Maureen Reynolds and Rick Ryder will be there. And if anybody listening wants to come, you can register by going to 911scholars.org. Okay, guys, we're back for another hour of discussing the big picture with 9/11. And, you know, one point of view I hear pretty often. I've heard it from a guy who's been on my show a couple times recently, Rolf Lindgren. He's been writing some press releases for the Scholars for 9/11 Truth Group, and he really wants to hammer on Building 7 for a couple of reasons. One is that it's so clear and straightforward for the newbies, and after all, we're really trying to reach the unconverted, aren't we? And then number two, we all agree on it, so we don't have to be at each other's throats all the time. So, do you think it would be a good idea to be doing more PR aimed at the unwashed masses and focusing on things like Building 7?
Well, I'm reminded of the University of Wisconsin, which we have in common, Kevin.
Oh, yeah.
We both
have 3 degrees from there, which puts us both 3 up on Dick Cheney, the draft-dodging dropout.
But what you're saying reminds me of the education/research function of professors. And, of course, most professors have tried to completely shirk their duties in the classroom or dealing with students and stick to research and maybe have a couple of PhD dissertation students, but you're pulling at the other end of the string and saying, oh, no, we ought to be all about education and a little research. Well, you can't make these across-the-board recommendations, especially for we of the unpaid research class. Some of us are just going to pursue this And, hey, I will, of course, respond to invitations and the like and do outreach, but that's not my main thing. My main thing is to investigate and write, and you just can't suppress that. Some of us are pretty good at it, and that's the way we're built. Other people are more outreach and activists and the like.
Well, you know, I think you do a pretty good job in your published stuff. In particular, the article, Some Holes in the Plane Stories, published in the 9/11 Conspiracy, I find that a good, succinct summary of what mostly is pretty well proven up evidence that most folks are going to accept. That's, you know, it's a good combination of some, you know, research and also education. But, you know, I can see why there are 9/11 truth activists who are just driven crazy by the situation, Morgan, because, you know, you had that high position in the Bush administration. You have really good credentials. And, you know, so that means that, you know, the good news for them, for the activists, is the good news is we've got, you know, this guy with these amazing credentials, Morgan Reynolds, on our side. And the bad news is all he wants to talk about is no planes. And you,
well,
can see why.
Hey, guess what? You can't control me. My own guy, and if I hadn't gotten anywhere in the straight world, the mainstream, tough, you know, that's Morgan for you. And this whole business about kind of appealing to put it in a negative way, the lowest common denominator, I'm not trying to reach out in a way that won't inconvenience anybody. If a truth is inconvenient, you should find a way, or I should, and others, to make it more convenient. Let's not suppress it. People are I have a lot more confidence in people than many of our so-called 9/11 truthers who want to say, if this turns out to be true, A.K. Dewdney, who I have no respect for anymore, basically says, hey, if I knew what you knew and it were true, I still wouldn't bring that out. I would still suppress it. I would still advise a researcher scientist, if you went on Fox News Channel, as I did, and somebody asked you about it, that you either have to say, what, no comment? Or you have to lie about it. I'm not going to lie about it.
You could just say, well, let's talk about Building 7.
Yeah, let's go back. And actually, you know, in that 3.5-minute clip, I did go back to the safer ground of Building 7. Now, Building 7 even hasn't had a really thorough analysis. There's something at work there that is unconventional, Kevin, because there has never – that's the tallest building, if you want to call it a conventional demolition, that has ever been dropped, first of all. You know, the Hudson Department story, over 40 stories, was the previous record. I think it was 39 or 40 stories. And this thing was so plumb, Kevin. Of course, we have these three video angles on it. It was just unbelievably, unearthly, you know, supernatural plumb how that thing fell. By contrast, there was that Landmark Hotel about a year ago. In time, that was a pretty close comparison. There's a little bit of tilt. You know, how perfect can you be? And then the debris pile. It's so neat. You know, on Judy's website, we have this photo from the North Tower, and you look down, and then where it's in good health, Building 7. And then we have the collapsed Building 7 from a similar view above. And the thing almost doesn't cover the roadway on either side. It is that neat an implosion. There is no visible impact whatever on the adjoining postal building or so-called federal building. You could have driven around Building 7 debris pile certainly with a Jeep Wrangler, you know, a four-wheel drive. It was that neat.
Yeah, that certainly does make you wonder. And it certainly indicates that the people that did this were fairly proficient at demolition. You know, whoever scripted this wasn't very proficient at doing it realistically enough to convince anybody with their eyes open.
Yeah.
But the technicians were good.
And we've made a lot of progress in reaching the American public without much, if any, mainstream help. Because polls show it, right? There are certainly 4 out of 10 Americans who doubt the official 9/11 story, and about half of those are hardcore. That is, people who will say, yeah, 9/11 was an inside job.
Right. And so we are making that kind of progress. And, you know, the activists are still, you know, a lot of activists are saying we need to focus on the things we all agree on and so on. But personally, you know, I don't find the stuff that you guys are saying and that Judy is saying to be particularly, you know, wildly improbable, you know, because we all pretty much have to agree at this point that the planes at the World Trade Center were distractions, that they served the purpose of creating a scapegoat or a purported explanation.
Well, but that was key. That was key, right. Of course. Right.
Right. Right. So whatever, you know, so you don't need the whole story of the hijackings and so on has been proven to be false. The cell phone calls and the nobody on a flight manifest and on and on and on. So it's very clear that we're not dealing with an actual hijacking story. That the planes were simply part of a ruse. And that means that, your idea of this ruse being created by other means than actually flying a big Boeing into the towers is not all that outrageous. Likewise, with the alternative demolition theories, since we know the military did this and used whatever they have, there's no reason to think that they wouldn't have used some stuff that isn't, you know, obvious. So there's nothing really wild and crazy about it.
Well, then why are people so agitated about Morgan, Rick, and Judy?
I think it's a big psychological thing that, a lot of 9/11 truth people just get tired of being insulted and called crazy and, you know, wild-eyed conspiracy theorist kind of thing. And they get tired of that. And then they see these ideas that look wild and crazy to them, and then they blame you for the fact that they're being called wild and crazy by their more conventional friends.
That I'm bringing them into disrepute.
Exactly.
Rick was pointing out earlier that the demolition was a taboo proposition up until the summer of 2005. And we're at that point on no planes where there is a solid core. It's growing. There's a lot of video fakery documentation, and the physics have been proven up. The official story, the silhouette of passage, this roadrunner type, this is not the way collisions occur. And a plane blending in or gliding in and into a building as if it were warm butter and all that, it's just absolute nonsense. I can't swallow that, even if it's for the sake of the movement. I can't lie for the truth, as it were.
So one more question that always comes up, of course, is that you have these people who who like to instantly get paranoid and think that anybody putting out anything that is seems dubious or wild and improbable must be an agent, and I was bent on spreading dissent in the community kind of thing. And in fact, Morgan, you're obviously not a terribly, prickly personality compared to these other people. But my point here would be that so many of these people associated with the no plane idea seem to be, just very, very, very prickly personalities. People who just spam you and insult everybody and rant and rave and, can't carry on a lucid conversation, can't write a lucid essay, and you're the obvious exception here, Morgan. You've written good essays. You can carry on a good conversation. You're a reasonably friendly guy. But what are all these other no-planers are complete nut jobs. What's going on with them?
There's truth to what you say. I think part of it is battle fatigue. They've fought uphill for so many years. I'm a little one of the fresher troops, but also by training and career, I'm used to having the person in the next office not share many of my beliefs or opinions. Right? This is the usual live and let live. Now, maybe I'm a little bit too tolerant, so to speak. But I'm like you in that sense, that I'm not agitated when somebody appears to speak a non-truth. I'm not I'm doing my own thing. I'm putting that out. Now, ultimately, as in the case of Professor Jones, I see there's a problem. I have a problem with him, and he's gotten so influential, I'm going to have to take out his work because it's not valid. So I'm not saying I'm completely sanguine about some of my colleagues in the movement, but...
I think that's where, I have to disagree with some of your remarks on that, but... Anyway, that's neither
Rick,
here nor
what's
there.
Your take on this?
Which particular aspect?
Well, we're talking about, the incivility and friction.
Okay, sure. I agree with Morgan in the sense that, if you look at, like, Webfury, being the original no-planer, and everyone will kind of agree with that. I mean, she had to basically spend a year basically getting smashed in forums and ridiculed and screamed at. All these people, these people are already been attacked for so many years that, and their only defense is basically attacking backs. And people also like Nico, who's always called this info, and at every turn he's an op or he's an agent, and he's done some of the best research out there. So it's really tough because to actually put forth this information on forums, like I've also been on forums like the 9/11 blogger, the Loose Change, or whatever the popular forums are out there, and it's just amazing how much crap you have to deal with because you would present evidence or analysis, and someone will just say you're wrong, and then they'll call you names and tell you why you're wrong and call you all sorts of things, and then they'll put you on red herrings. Like I had a fight with this guy Carl Weiss a lot, and just they'll like give you pages and pages of questions and all stuff, and you'll answer them meticulously. And then they'll still just say you're wrong, and it's just it just gets extremely tiring. So finally, some of these people will just say, "You're just wasting my time, my energy. You're pissing me off," and then they just go off.
That's unfortunate because
I don't condone that, but I can understand why it happens. So
I think it's very, very unfortunate for for the no plane cause because it's so many of us just assume that there's a problem with that idea because our email boxes are getting spammed by people ranting and raving all the time. I guess I wasn't there at the beginning when people like Nico were doing that early research and Holmgren. I came on a little later, and I know those guys feel bad that that those of us who came later got more glory than they did or something. But I've just never really seen the lucid arguments from anybody in this camp. Except maybe Morgan, you're the most calm and lucid person out there, which is that's saying something.
Everybody's skills are not the same. For example, Webfury educated herself on videos and has made some fine contributions, but she's not going to write a long essay, et cetera, making all the points and. The patient scholarly way that I'm capable of, let's say. But if you want to talk about somebody who's lucid, until recently, Gerard Holmgren, the Sydney, Australian musician, there's nobody more lucid. I mean, he's a debater extraordinaire. And
really?
He's made some good contributions, but lamentably, he's lost it, at least temporarily, in my opinion.
Okay, well, we're going to have to lose it temporarily here, too, because we're going into a break, but we will return. Stay tuned. Okay, let's talk about the truth and the search for the truth and the fact that sometimes you have to pursue the truth no matter where it leads. Even if it makes you look like a crazy person, which is pretty much where just about all of us in the 9/11 truth movement have found ourselves at one point or another, surrounded by sheeple who just don't get it and don't want to get it. And even within our community, we have folks out there who appear to be to the rest of the 9/11 truth movement, sort of what the 9/11 truth movement is to the sheeple. That is folks like Morgan Reynolds and Rick Ryder, who are pursuing the cutting edge of research into the mysterious aspects of the plane stories on 9/11. And I guess I'm at a point, guys, where it's so obvious that these were demolitions that were part of a psyop to scare the pants off the people, bring in the post 9/11 world with its wars and its shredding the Constitution. This is all pretty obvious. The whole thing was built around those great images of the buildings being blown to bits with people inside them. Horrific footage, you know, Hollywood-style spectacular. You know, that's all pretty clear. The question of exactly how the plane the distractions were set up is, to me, kind of peripheral. It's important to prove that the official story is false, and I think we've done that, you know, seven ways from Sunday. But as far as having to, you know, get really, you know, precise about it, and, you know, is it really that important whether Dave Von Kleist is right and something with a pod flew into the World Trade Center, or you guys are right and perhaps nothing did, or, you know, it was all video illusion and explosives planted in the shape of a cutout of a plane? I mean, what's the difference? You know, why is it important?
Well, are you interested in justice, Kevin?
Of course.
Well, then you've got to convict perpetrators, the real perpetrators. And to do so, you've got to prove with valid evidence. You can't go in there with contaminated stories. And so it's like I said earlier, it's a double jeopardy issue. And now the truth, of course, is important on its own. For example, it's important to convict by the bar of history, which I think we, as you pointed out, we've in a sense already accomplished to most people's satisfaction in the 9/11 truth movement. But it to me, it's frustrating to hear you say this as a Muslim, because, as you know, they need the plane story to have Arab hijackers. If there are no commercial planes and certainly no planes, their whole world domination and the war on the Muslim world project collapses. The whole pretext that we were attacked by these dastardly foreigners in a Pearl Harbor-type stink attack, it's absolute rubbish. Now, I put it to you, how can this story stay glued together this long, right? I mean, on its face, I thought we would be further along at this point, being the, I guess, the hopeless romantic optimist that I am. But their story, as you pointed out, is so lame. It's so farcical. Remember a year ago in June, it was brought out that the FBI had no hard evidence to want on the number one of the most wanted list, OBL, for the attacks of 9/11. In other words, they don't have anything on him. In truth, you know, it's just so lame. And the American public are they stupid, disinterested, head in the sand, willfully ignorant?
All of the above.
well, Kevin, also, if you just stop at controlled demolition, you say, okay, controlled demolition is enough, we go to court, we can arrest all the perps, yada, yada.
Well, yeah, you still got the fake planes. I mean, either way, whether the planes are actual planes or literally fake planes, they're a distraction, because you know that they would have had to make sure those planes hit. Therefore, it could not have been hijackers. We know it wasn't hijackers.
Kevin, what you gained by TV fakery and no planes is media complicity. So they, you know, you can.
We know that. We know that already.
Well, not to the degree as what you can gain, because then you actually have people who are deep within doing all this stuff. But it was, you know, you could just have useful idiots otherwise. They're just kind of like, you know, dum-de-dum, oh, it's Osama, you know, all that type of stuff. But if they actually did went through a TV fakery, there has to be actual people inside doing all the stuff. It's not, there's no accident at that point.
Right, but see, we know that the intelligence agencies infiltrate the media, so we know that some of the people in the media and key nodes are actually working for these rogue networks and intelligence agencies. We already know that. You know, we've known about Project Mockingbird for decades.
But now we have proof.
Back up. How did we all come to know it was demolition and therefore an inside job? That was
because crazy people like you were out there telling us.
Exactly. And we're going to do the same thing on no planes. Now, the no planes thing is actually more important, I would argue, than the method of the it's kind of a close 1-2, but I would rank no planes number one, for the very reason Rick is pointing to, and that is the control of the mass media, the corporate media. You know, some all you need is basically 10 corporations. They are the enforcement arm, as Joseph Keith puts it, another no-planer. They are the enforcement arm of the powers that be. That's the way they control the world. And when we point out, the people are going to be terribly disappointed to find out that pretty Katie Couric and trustworthy Charles Gibson and the lot of them are in on it, telling them lies and using fake stuff. It's about as real as the national flag below the speed skaters in the Olympics, you know.
Yeah, well,
that's the first 10 line.
You know, the other question that comes up when we talk about the TV fakery and stuff, and I have to admit, I've seen images that seem to support some of the arguments that have been made for TV fakery, the arguments that these videos are fake that you've made, Morgan. Mm-hmm. There definitely are some images that that seem to indicate that.
But every one of them.
the question that arises then is, okay, so we've got some, you know, some fake video or some video that's been tweaked or is fake or something, you know, it's not the original pristine authentic footage of an actual big Boeing going into the tower. Okay, so we've got that footage, but that doesn't necessarily tell us where that footage came from, you know.
There are nearly 40 of these videos that purport to portray some part of the WTC.
And do we have a good chain of evidence on them?
Hmm?
Do we have a good chain of evidence?
No, we don't usually. Right. You know, to have any one of these videos that are on the Internet admitted into a court of law as evidence, you have to have, number one, the photographer who will testify under oath and under hostile cross-examination. You have to have the chain of custody for these pixels that are depicted on the screen. And number three, reassurance or proof, if you will, of non-manipulation.
That's going to be a hard one, huh?
It's going to be real hard. Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's like the Naught A brothers, you know. Oh, I see some stuff up there. Listen, I just discovered this last week or weekend when I was looking at real plane crashes. You know, for example, they have an Air France Boeing 737 go off into the woods a B-52 bomber in 1994 go into the ground when it was rehearsing tricks for an air show. And it's remarkable how black and charcoal the smoke is. Of course, you see the fireballs as well. Compared to both tower hits, it's very much white and gray. It's not like a real airliner crash.
Interesting, and we'll pick this up, talk about real versus fake images in just a sec. Okay, we're back here on 9/11 and Empire Radio. This is your host, Kevin Barrett, talking to Morgan Reynolds and Rick Ryder about some of the cutting-edge, controversial 9/11 research that they've done. Our call-in number here is toll-free 888-202-1984. That's 888-202-1984. Or if you have unlimited long distance, you can save the good we the people a few bucks by calling 512-646-1984. That's 512-646-1984. All right, guys. Well, so, Rick, how did you get involved in writing articles with Morgan Reynolds and analyzing some of the physical evidence on 9/11?
Well, it's kind of an interesting story. I actually met Morgan for the first time shortly after his 2005 article at a 9/11 Truth Convergence thing sponsored by 911truth.org down in front of D.C. And that was at the time when, again, you couldn't really talk about controlled demolition and all that stuff. And then I found out Morgan was an economist. I happened to support the Liberty Dollar. I introduced him to that, you know, got his card. And then, like, 3 months later, I was like, hey, I'm an engineer. You're probably writing some more articles. If you ever need some analysis done, you know, drop me an email. And sure enough, the next day he said, hey, can you look at how a plane would attack a building? And initially I was like, oh, crap. Morgan Reynolds is a no-planer. And I was going to prove him wrong by doing some calculations for him and show him why
all this video stuff is just nothing. You're looking for, you know, in the wrong places. Just go back to demolition and the other stuff or whatever. So, and then after a while, I went to like places like Web Furry's site and downloaded a lot of the videos, and I kept watching and watching and watching, and you know, it just something just didn't sit right, and I just started like doing a little bit of analysis, like what I would expect, how the torque should be, how the slowdown should be, and all this stuff, and it just didn't make any sense. Plus, there's some videos where wings just disappear, you know, and these planes like blob in the air, and it just, yeah, it's just very, very weird stuff. So I slowly came to be, quote-unquote, a no-planer.
And the question would come up then, okay, so we've seen these videos that have problems. Morgan says they all have problems. I've seen a couple that seem to very clearly have problems. Now, does the existence of some or all videos of the North Tower hit, I'm sorry, the second hit, the South Tower hit, that have problems, does that really prove that there wasn't a plane crash? And the corollary question to that is, how would these perps know that nobody would get that second crash with their handy cam? Because everybody's down there pointing their cameras at the towers at that point. So you think that would be pretty high risk.
Well, the physics prove it for me, Kevin. I don't care what any video shows or does not show. In other words, for example, there's no plane debris in the gashes in the towers. There's none. There's no evidence of any debris below the impact hull. An aluminum plane can't stand up to this kind of strength, you know, and a heavyweight steel tower. In other words, if you repeal Newton's three laws of motion, yeah, then you can get this silhouette of passage and the other rubbish. I can remember at the time actually asking me myself, I said, is this what an aluminum plane would actually do? And you know how you look around and you just say, well, nobody else is challenging it. Gee, I guess I'm wrong. I can remember that very morning going to a neighbor's office there at the Labor Department, which is exactly two blocks from Capitol Hill. So I could have been in the line of fire conceivably, right, if they were going to hit the Capitol building. And I looked up at this building, the tower, with a smudge pot really going, this black smoke, and I said, that building will not fall. And then I spent the rest of the morning scrambling back to my apartment, and I didn't have a TV, so I wasn't psyoped, but I learned, gee whiz, how long could I be, you know? And I just put it on the back shelf and spent my 16 months at the U.S. Department of Labor. It wasn't until I left that I really started thinking about this. And the key was the invasion of Iraq on March 20, 2003. And I said, well, everybody in town, meaning Washington, D.C., who's anybody, really knows this is all a bunch of lies. And I said, gee, if they'd actually go halfway around the world, invade another country that poses no threat whatever to the United States, if they'd lie about that, what else would they lie about? Uh-oh. That's when I first started investigating 9/11 and writing a little bit on it. So,
well, that was what got me really suspicious. When that Iraq invasion went ahead and happened, is I thought that was, you know, it was all going to get headed off. It was just sort of a threat. It turned out it was all set in stone. And so when that happened, I did start to really scratch my head about 9/11, but I didn't really get into the you know, looking hard at it for another year after that, I guess. Or half year. But yeah, at this Madison conference, you know, it's going to be interesting because, you know, we have an opportunity to get some media coverage, and yet there's, of course, the more conventional intimate of the 9/11 truth people are going to be very unhappy, and they're going to, you know, have even more reasons to be upset with us if the media coverage out of this Madison conference focuses in a kind of a circusy way on, you know, on these seemingly, you know, bizarre, improbable ideas, even as true as they may be. How do you think we should try to convey this kind of material to the media?
Well, I don't hold much confidence in the media ever really getting any serious access. That's not the way it's going to happen. It's going to happen inch by inch, the way it's been going. Once somebody turns, they never turn back. They know. And in a sense, you're right that it's details or, you know, and we're turning up stuff every month. So, but they know their own government or sections of their own government, and no doubt the powers that be, the more permanent powers behind it, they did it. They murdered 3,000 plus, and it's completely intolerable to just turn away and hope somehow it'll be better. I mean, they've been escalating this thing. You know, the Oklahoma City bombing, Dr. Judy Wood on her website shows you the interior, an interior view of WTC Building 6. And then next to it, the Murrah Building before they demoed the rest, the other half of it. And it just looks exactly like the interior. In other words, they're just like these circular cuts out of the building. So maybe that's a little bit, but the point is they have been, the hubris is going to bring them down. They keep on stepping it up every time.
And Kevin, you got to realize that even if you stay within the bounds and talk about WTC7, the media is still going to trash talk you and talk down upon you and call you crazy anyway. So,
right, but you just hope somebody's going to Google WTC7 when they see that. You know, that's the experience I've had, is that you know, they're. Some of the audience is actually going to get on the internet and Google this stuff. And if the first thing they Google is WTC7, that might actually work better than if they Google no plane.
But, I mean, you can't help but stumble upon it all.
Right. And I went out to Seattle, and I got people who were bound to be offended or upset anyway. In other words, or Rick knows my National Press Club talk where, yeah, I open with the Bill. First of all, you show that the official story can't hold any water at all. And then you show, okay, well, look at Building 7, Buildings 1 and 2, and Pentagon. Okay, people are good with the Pentagon. Even Shanksville, you know, this absurd little hole, 20 feet by 10 feet by 6 feet deep and not an airplane part in it, that's absurd.
It is.
And then you go to the, now we're on taboo ground. This is when people start squirming, you know. And hey, I'm going to prove to you there was no plane crash into either building, okay? Yeah, but millions saw it on TV, and, you know, yeah. Right. You know, yeah, we've seen Tom and Jerry cartoons, et cetera. We've seen stuff. People are just, how can they be this unsophisticated? They see stuff like here it comes to mind, the Ford Edge, their new crossover SUV, and they show the car running alongside the building, you know, on two wheels out in space. Well, we know this is dumb, right? We know this is an ad. Or there's a GMC pickup ad where the pickup goes vertical up the building and then down the building, and you're really cool. Well, okay, we know that's an ad, that's a special effect. But how can people believe, be this trustworthy, that if Charles Gibson tells you, oh, yeah, this is really true, and not question it?
Right. Good point. All right. We're back on 9/11 and Empire Radio. This is your host, Kevin Barrett. I'm talking with Morgan Reynolds and Rick Ryder. And where were we there, Morgan, when you got cut off so rudely?
Gee whiz. hey, well, let's go to this. Let me play victim for a change.
oh, poor little Morgan. Okay, so
yeah.
Tell me about it.
Steve Jones does this so well with his little choir boy act, and you're sticking up for us. I give you credit in that you're willing to discuss this issue of planes, no planes, or extraordinary unconventional weapons might have been used at the World Trade Center. Are you going to stand up for us now, Kevin, when the truth movement's trying to stone us? This is
I will. I'll stand up for your right to do your research and to join the discussion. And that's why I'm going to be in Madison. But I have to tell you that in the Madison Conference, I'm going to be the designated defender of Steve Jones because nobody else is coming there to take that position.
Okay, well, I wish Dr. Jones would be there.
Well,
I would love
to
have him in a debate with Judy Wood and myself or, you know, however. I would love that. I don't think it's ever going to happen.
Well, it may or may not. But, you know, the thing is, Morgan, Steve has probably been, you know, more collegial than the people who've been giving him a hard time, or most of them anyway. So, and he's, you know, he has, you know, taken it on the chin from some, you know, from some whack out people as well as from the, you know, the more somewhat sensible folks like yourself. And I think, you know, he's kind of tired of the fierce battle in the public arena kind of thing. So I don't really blame him that much for not coming. I wish he would. But I think somebody, you know, needs to try to present his position just to see how it, you know, how it bounces off the other positions there. And I actually think that, you know, he's not.
Well, I don't know if he's really tired of this, we'll call it infighting. But if you look at his journal, Kevin, there's a remarkable percentage in the neighborhood of roughly half that are what I would call hit pieces on the Dew and Judy Wood or the Andor Morgan and the no plane issue. It's like he's going out and in a sense commissioning these things. If either of these propositions were so silly and meritless, why spend all these resources on supposedly hitting it up real good when, you know, hey, I can't find anything really of merit going on over there?
Well,
the
thought would be to try to critique it. I mean, that's theoretically what should be done in an academic journal, would be for people to present their conflicting views in the form of mutual critiques to try to get at the truth.
You know, it's
and how
like
well
a
they're
higher,
doing that is perhaps debatable.
It's like a higher brow version of what goes on in these forums where nobody does any research, but they're very upset about the person or the results that they're seeing. So it's just, you know, one kind of spiteful attack after the other. So at any rate, my point is that I guess none of our hands are entirely clean in this matter, but I can't just sit here and say, oh, yeah, Dr. Jones is tired of all this, and he's not going to have any cease and desist that I can see. And here, I'm not sure we really got this point on the record, and that is the way we got to consensus on controlled demolition, Kevin, is through a lot of hard work. And finally, people came around. In other words, the original researchers fought the good fight, they stuck with it, and eventually prevailed. And I predict that the same will be true on No Planes and Dew, even though it's an early stage.
Well, time will certainly tell. And if that turns out to be the case, then people who will have come to this Madison conference and seen you guys with these ideas will be, you know, one leg up on everybody else. They'll be able to tell our grandchildren about it, which is actually one of the great things about 9/11 Truth. You know, we're participating in history in a really unprecedented way. I don't think there's ever been a situation like this before where the entire planet was wired in to such a spectacular event.
And it's a grassroots, it's a bottoms-up thing.
That's right. And it's, you know, it's such a shift in worldview for most people when they do figure this out. And so, you know, I think that people should think about, you know, taking an interest in it. People who are sort of hanging back should, you know, think about what are you going to tell your grandchildren? What are you going to, you know, how are you going to look back at this 10 years from now? Were you on the sidelines when this was going on, or were you actually involved in it? And people who are involved in this honorably are going to look very, very good in retrospect.
Well, Rick is a young person. Give us your insight into the impact of 9/11 on our college generation.
Well, unfortunately, I don't have good results from MIT because everyone here thinks they know everything. However, young people I've met, especially at the high school level, have been extremely open to this, and it definitely opens their eyes to what they're being taught in school. And once they know something like 9/11, they start questioning the teachers in school, like my little brother does. And he gets a rise out of the history teacher and whatnot for basically taking them to task sometimes. So I really think, if one good thing could have come from all this, and I think that it's hard to even say that, is that I think it's forced people to kind of reevaluate their worldview and how the world works. And that's extremely powerful. Like Morgan said, once you figure this all out, you never go back. And and so I think that it's really affecting the kids these days, especially that are seeing it and seeing their rights being taken away, and are, rebelling, essentially, from this.
Yeah, getting back to that, the fact that your colleagues at MIT think they know everything, now, how does that work? You know, I don't have much of a sciences education. My dad was an engineer, but, when I started doing this 9/11 truth stuff, I would have engineers come up to me at my little teach-ins at the University of Wisconsin, and they would explain to me calmly these, preposterous things, these ludicrous explanations for what happened to the towers in Building 7, of course, the jet fuel melted all the steel. It does that, and that's one of the less ludicrous ones. And these are engineers. Oh, I'm an engineer. You're not an engineer. What do you know?
we have some of the captain of disinfo agents here, in fact, in one of the original actual, published journal, quote-unquote, respectable persons was the Tom Eager, the mechanical material science engineer here, and he gives talks about once a year or twice a year to other MIT professors, and they teach classes on stuff, and it's always brought up on how, in 2002 when I was taking mechanics class, we actually had the mechanics teacher tell us why and how the towers fell because of the steel flanges melting and wobbling and all this stuff. So we essentially got indoctrinated, even by our own teachers here, and
They told you that it could fossil fuel fire could melt steel.
Yeah, that was she was an engineer. She's a I'm not picking on females because Tom Eager is a male, obviously. And there's a bunch of professors throughout MIT that have some sort of 9/11 connection, and they give talks or when they teach classes, the towers falling for mechanics classes is a interesting problem, and they always say the traditional the civil engineer explanation that from that one report from 2002, how basically the steel got really, really, really hot and the metal started to warp and wobble and then it basically crashed down and, complete garbage. But we were taught it right in class. And, to a naive student who believes everything the professor says, you nod your head and go, oh, okay, and you walk out and I guess that's how it fell.
Well, after talking to those engineers at my teach-ins, it made me really concerned about even, going into buildings because, if people like that are building them, are these things going to stand up,
Right.
Should I even get on a plane if these engineers are building these things? Is it going to stay in the air?
Well, they couldn't in this class or in these lectures or talks show a couple of the pictures. For example, on Dr. Judy Wood. Hey, by the way, Kevin, I want to plug my website, and Rick is the webmaster, nomoregames.net, for listeners who want to go read more of Morgan Reynolds and Associates. But right now I'm on drjudywood.co.uk. That's her new address. And there's a couple of pictures here under her Star Wars Directed Energy Weapons or do article, and the first one is my favorite picture of WTC, the North Tower turning to dust, and this is from a helicopter, and you just see the whole tower is turning to dust, and it's shooting out in various directions and going up, and to call this a collapse, or Judy's favorite is the snowball picture where in about the middle of the building, around floors 40 to 50, first of all, the top 60 or so stories are gone. And then there's this massive snowball, and you cannot see great masses of material falling down. So to talk about this as some kind of pancake collapse is absurd just by a 10-second video or a couple of pictures. You got to make observations.
That's true. Who do you believe, me or your own eyes?
Right.
I think it was Groucho Marx that said that. Yeah, those towers were clearly blown to kingdom come, and Judy's metaphor of trees being turned to sawdust from the top down is a good one.
Yeah.
All right, well, hey, thanks, Morgan and Rick. It's been good talking to you.
Thanks for having us, Kevin.
Okay, and I look forward to seeing you at the Science of 9/11 conference in Madison, Wisconsin. People can join us there by going to 911scholars.org and checking out the conference. All right. First weekend in August, the 3rd and the 5th. Okay, see you there.
Thanks.
All right. And see you all next week. Just give us a treat.